Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, eco-troubadour Stan Slaughter will take us on a journey underground to learn about a subterranean world many of us never think about. He'll explain how a wide range of topics that are important to us today, global warming, the microbiome, agricultural productivity, crop yield, and carbon sequestration, are all connected by something we often overlook, the soil. Slaughter's talk describes new possibilities for making sustainable change that seem hopeful and doable, especially for those of us living in the Midwest, where farmland is all around us. It turns out that the good earth itself has the power to help solve issues related to health, water, climate, and conservation. This show is recorded May 28th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Vollen, a member of the forum committee. The forum exists to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning, we're really privileged to have Stan Slaughter. I've known Stan for about 30 years. He was out there working at the grassroots level, teaching about ecology, and especially the ecology of the soil. He developed methods of composting, and then he went around singing about it at all over the country. And that's why he's also called the Eco Troubadour. I read a lot of the information about climate change, and in fact, sequestration of carbon is a major topic these days, and so we're very fortunate that he will have an expert here to fill us in on that. So with no further ado, I'll give it to Stan.
Thank you. Well, it's good to be back at All Souls. Some of you may know that I've been involved for many, many years. Weddings, funerals, Green Party meetings, concerts in Conover, and I lived about 2 miles from here throughout most of the 90s, so it was a lot of fun to do, to be here. Recently, I've been watching some revolutions, and you're living through some too, I think you know. There's a fellow named Peter Diamandis, who's the head of the XPRIZE Foundation, and that's the people who got the first, you know, the prize for the first ship that would fly up into orbit and land again. They're just about to test Elon Musk and those guys, testing this gigantic booster rocket that's the largest ever, bigger than anything NASA's ever built. But they give high-tech prizes for these achievements. And he gave the example of Lindbergh, and that there was a $25,000 prize for the first person to fly across the Atlantic. But the people who tried spent over $200,000 to get there. And within 3 years after Lindbergh's flight, the number of airplanes in the world's tripled. And we're in a kind of a situation where between the technological revolution of computers and the awareness of what's going on in the world, we're going to see some enormous changes. And we're seeing them now, and they're happening faster than we can actually perceive. This is exponential change, and we can only see it at this point or imperfectly analyze what's happening today, but these flows of information are much bigger than we've ever seen, and they're happening so much faster that we really have no idea what's happening in our world. One of the books that I'll point to afterwards, if you have a chance to come by and talk with me, is a book called The Hidden Half of Nature. And David Montgomery and his wife are the authors, and he says, we're on the upside of life, we're on the living side of life, but half of life is not alive. Half of life is what happens between death and birth. And the presence of organic matter in the soil, the presence of that transformation is half of life. And we are on the upside. We're looking for green grass and cute animals. But David says the revolution in the understanding of the microbiome of the soil and the human gut is the most important revolution in human history since we learned that the earth revolves around the sun 400 years ago. A massive revolution. We're going to see, for example, something that's already happening. If you have chronic colitis, the answer to that is to change your microbiome. And the way that's done, if I may say this at least a little impolitely, is a fecal transplant. Nobody's confused about what I'm saying. The point is, we don't nourish our guts. We don't take care of our guts. 70% of your immune function is created by secretions of the bacteria in your colon. The people with the most diverse guts are the people with the healthiest bodies. The healthiest immune systems in the world come from Bavarian farm children who live in homes connected to the barn directly. I was fortunate enough to be a 4-H farm boy on a 245-acre farm, walking, swimming in a pond that the cows used, and you'd come out with green feet. But guess what? I don't get sick. And I can't explain it because I'm not that good of a dieter. So this is not a little thing. It's a huge thing. And the idea that many, many diseases may well be cured by a concoction of bacteria. The microbiome of the soil has also exploded. A lot of it is the computer revolution. I'll talk about this guy. Yeah, he's my man. Ron Helland. He was aware of the Human Genome Project, 2003. Some tens of billions of dollars to sequence the human genome, right? He says we can do it now on a laptop in 15 minutes for $50. And we do it on bacteria. Humans have 23,000 genes. Bacteria have 75,000 genes. Now, that's a little humbling, perhaps, but a bacteria has three times more genes than you, and we can still sequence it on a laptop in 15 minutes. He thinks it'll go down to 5 minutes and $5. And the ability to know what critter is here, what they do, what their specific genetics are, and how they operate together has exploded our knowledge of both the gut and the soil. Okay. Ron Helland lived, before he made his millions, in the San Joaquin Valley. Now, if you're familiar with the San Joaquin Valley, it's a desert. It's the floodplain of the San Joaquin River, comes out of Sequoia National Park, comes out and floods that valley. It's hot, it's dry, it's river sand and silt. And it's so hot that nematodes come in and kill the crops. So Ron, what crop do they want to be the best, most beautiful crop in the San Joaquin Valley? And the answer is football fields. So Ron made millions of dollars hauling in live, humus-laden, compost-rich soils, big layers of those, and knowing exactly how to do it, to have lush, beautiful playing fields. Okay, so he was doing that routinely, had a big reputation for doing that. He was about to do the church's playing fields, and he brought the compost, and he dumped it on the parking lot, and then it rained for 6 months in San Joaquin Valley, which is pretty unusual. Couldn't spread it. So he came back 6 months later, and this really active compost mix needed some nutrients to stay alive. Normally they have the soil and the minerals they could get to. So what happened was, when he scraped off all the compost and hauled it away, there was no more asphalt. It was only clean white rocks where the asphalt had been in the circle where the compost was. In 6 months, they had learned to metabolize petroleum and eat it and use it. And Ron was smart enough to scrape the bottom, keep that bottom layer of compost that had done that, and start to work with it. And what he found was the asphalt was totally metabolized. There were 5,700 species, 270 genera, genuses, five creatures that were too strange to classify, could have been dropped by an alien, had no idea, fungus, bacteria, no, algae. And what I understand is 50-some species previously unknown to science. So those guys have got to work. And see, if Craig and I are bacteria, and I walk up and shake hands with Craig, we're now cousins because they can change. They can. I could slip him a gene in this handshake. And so the ability to make genetic change is not just 20 minutes a generation, which is how fast the generations go, but it's the ability to directly transfer genes. So what Ron did was he created a 12-strain compost tea mixture, and he keeps the 12 strains culturing separately. He mixes them together and uses them as compost tea. In large-scale agriculture, it's really prohibitive to try and spread enough compost to do anything to change the soil. But if you can spread worm manure tea or compost tea or other kinds of tea, you can change the bacteriological system, which can then help change the soil. So what they found out was that Ron's mixture was completely proof against nematode attack. And so they devised a test with Monsanto, 1,000 new strawberry transplants into a field known to be laden with nematodes. It's roundworms, pet predators, love to eat the tiny roots of fresh plants. So Monsanto put out 1,000 plants, Syngenta put out 1,000 plants, and Ron put out 1,000 plants. And they sprayed their best anti-nematode spray on these 1,000 plants. Monsanto lost 600. Syngenta lost 600. Ron lost 6. So what happens? They believe that one of the critters in that tea injects into the strawberry plant a gene that makes them systemically immune to the effects of a nematode. Well, how valuable would that be? Well, say, confers systemic genetic immunity to groundworms. He now sells this tea on 4 continents. He sells 10,000-gallon tanker trucks of this tea to growers. He recently turned down a 10-figure check from Monsanto. What would it mean if that went in Monsanto's hands? Give them another giant leg up on the world. On their domination. He also recently rebuffed a major pharmaceutical company who wanted to start the study and find out what that's about. Where did this come from? It came from the microbial community that was given a new substrate to work on, given something new to do. And this is the kind of hypothesis. My brother is a fruit tree breeder in California, personal friend of Ron's. So I've had 2 conversations with Ron over the last 6 months about his work. He now lives in Arizona in a retirement community with a really good internet connection to the people who are running his business in Fresno. So before farming, nature was in charge. Wide diversity of plants, grazing animals concentrated by predators. If you're a wildebeest and you wander off too far, you don't ever get back to the herd, okay? And kept moving by predators. Maximum coverage of the soil and protection of the soil with plants. A buildup and maintenance of soil reserves. Most native soils have between 4% and 6% organic matter. You took the soil, fried it to ashes, 6% of it would have been carbon-based live material that would have floated off in the air. That's excellent. Maximum water retention, living roots at every season, and uncontrolled fire. In other words, burn when it burns. Don't worry about Smokey the Bear. With farming, man's in charge. He plants monocultures. Grazing animals are confined, allowed to roam, never moved, and predators are eliminated. Maximum bearing and plowing of the soil. Soil temperatures approach 140 degrees, at which time there is no life. Destruction of humus reserves through direct oxidation. I don't know how to put a video in a PowerPoint, but I have a video from NASA of the brown spot that occurs in the United States in spring when we plow. And the brown is the emission of the carbon dioxide that's exposed and suddenly is oxidized by A, more bacteria getting a chance to look at it, and B, the sun. Direct oxidation, erosion, and crop usage. Minimum water retention, long periods with no live plants. Controlled fire, soil compaction, high soil temperatures, and the fertilizer effect. Plants are on welfare. We fertilize them. In nature, there's no fertilizer. There's manure, there's the cycling of nutrients. And when we provide the fertilizer for the plant, first of all, it's incomplete. It's not the gorgeous mix of nutrients that nature provides, but also plants don't have to work for it. We'll talk about where that leads in just a little bit. Okay, almost all of the soils in the world have been massively degraded. Recent estimate is 70% of all the carbon that used to be in the soils when we got them is now in the air. And that's carbon. It's not carbon dioxide. When we talk about global warming, carbon weighs 12. Carbon dioxide weighs 44 because you get two heavy oxygens hanging on. So when we talk about billions of tons of carbon emissions, billions of tons of carbon dioxide emissions, the carbon dioxide emissions add up a lot faster. But when you're dealing with plants, they obviously suck up the carbon, crack the carbon dioxide, give us the oxygen back, and sequester the carbon directly. Very powerful move. Something that we will not be able to, if we sequester carbon dioxide, we're going to be pumping heavy carbon dioxide directly into the soil, and there's nothing can do it like a plant. Soils in the plain states had high native organic matter contents of 4 to 6%. Now, 1% is fairly common. With no-till in the last 20 years, we're getting back up a little bit, 2, maybe 3. Let's talk about what's possible. Some total of carbon emissions, carbon contribution from fossil fuels, is 11 billion tons of carbon per year. Now, that's something like 35 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year. The soil holds 2,000 billion tons of carbon, and that's in its current state. We've got potential here. These are the annual transfer rates. Just for example, the ocean holds 38,000 billion tons of carbon dioxide. The atmosphere, 730 billion tons. The industrial is 6.3 billion tons. So yes, it seems like a lot, and yes, it is, but we're playing in a very big system. And there are ways to change this. The short stack here is indeed the industrial emissions. And this is the concentration. So this is the chart the Republicans can't get around, you know. It's like, so one of the quotes in the book called Cows Save the Planet: if the world's agricultural land could gain 2% organic matter, all the world's fossil fuel emissions since the start of the industrial age could be sequestered. With a concerted effort, possibly, the only way this would happen would be under a world dictatorship. With a concerted effort, this could happen in 10 years. We have farm fields in Emporia, Kansas, that are rising by 1% organic matter per year under a kind of system I'm going to describe. The other thing that's a little scary is if we stopped all carbon emissions today, it would take 1,000 years to sequester our accumulated emissions at current rates. We don't have that long. So there's something in the air. And what it is, a complete change in agriculture. This is the Washington Post from May 17th. If you're getting this article, Climate Change Solution Beneath Our Feet. There's too much carbon in the atmosphere and not enough in the ground where it's useful. Healthy soil can help flip the picture. This is, I think, it certainly features the University of California, Davis, but they're only one of many places that are working on this. So, carbon smart farming, very, very powerful. The cool thing about it is, you know the technology we need? A bunch of seeds and a bunch of animals. So what does it feature? Rapid carbon sequestration, intensive cover crop cocktails. So instead of planting rye after the corn, you might plant 30 crops, a mix, a broad mix of annuals and perennials. Aerial seeding through maturing crops. My brother is a conventional farmer. He's got a whole tank of Roundup. But guess what? He hires an airplane to fly through his corn in July and drop seeds through it. And it's damp down under there, and the seeds sprout. And by the time he harvests his corn, he's got green grass everywhere, a mix of plants. Iowa, 5 years ago, went from 3,000 acres of cover crops to 300,000 acres of cover crops in 1 year. This is an exploding field. Interplanting, crops planted in pastures. In other words, they have these strange planters now that can go through and poke a hole and poke seed in it. Drive through grass. So what are they doing now? They're planting soybeans in the middle of a pasture and they never till it. Guess what happens? All the health in the soil grows a pretty good soybean crop. And when it's done, you drive over the top of it and cut the soybeans off. Let the grass grow back up through it. Do you get as many soybeans as you get the other way? No. 60, 70, 80%? How much did you spend? 5%? Just the cost of the seeds and the past, you know, you don't fertilize, you don't use herbicides, you don't use pesticides, and all you do is drive through it later. So yes, our yield is down, but our costs went through the floor. Mob grazing cattle, chickens, sheep, pigs, a fivefold increase in stocking rates. If we do mob grazing like the predators, we do electric fences, we move them every day. Let's talk about that. But on a farm, you can increase the number of animals by fivefold because we're turning them into a mob. Rapid buildup of organic matter with no losses, because there's no time sunlight hits the ground, and there's no time rain can cause rapid erosion. It moderates soil temperature, improves rain infiltration and water quality, lowers input costs because there's no fertilizer, no herbicide, and no tillage, and low-tech equipment needed. More advantages. It increases local food security. Farmers go from 3 crops to 15. Producing a wide variety of nutrient-dense human food with more natural vitamins and minerals, fewer pesticides, herbicides, and better taste. Increasing pollinators, earthworms, and dung beetles. I remember seeing dung beetles on my farm, but my dad was upset about the flies that were bugging the cows, so he started putting chemicals out, and all the dung beetles disappeared. Very sensitive. Why wouldn't they be sensitive? Well, they lay their eggs in the dung. You know, if you do a systemic poison to kill the flies on the cows, you kill their dung beetles. There's stories of these mob grazing farmers who find out that almost all the visible manure in their paddock is underground by the next day. Dime-sized holes in the ground with balls of manure underground. What's that going to do for the humus content? What's it going to do for the permeability of the water? Decreased agricultural runoff, vastly reducing energy use in agriculture, building diversity and system resilience, keeps water on local landscapes, springs return. The father of this movement, Alan Savory, is from Zimbabwe. He took the Minister of Agriculture around and showed him that, you know, this is historically a spring, but guess what? 5 years later, it's running. Every little hoof makes a little dimple, and every little dimple holds the water right where it is. And then the infiltration that's occurring works even in brittle landscapes like South Africa and Zimbabwe. You got vegetation standing on top of the ground. Cows knock it over, chew it up, eat it, pass it through a warm, wet herbivore gut, fill it with bacteria, and put it back on the ground. Let's see. Keeps water on spring returns, cooling the local landscape, and stabilizing the weather. This is a great book, The Ecology of Care. Daikon radish roots are planted. They break the soil open 15 inches. I've seen daikons that were 6 inches in diameter and 40 inches deep. And what happens when it dies and rots? It's a tunnel straight into the subsoil. They're bringing materials up. Cover crops. Well, they improve pest management, weed suppression, pathogen suppression, nematode suppression, environmental quality by reducing the leaching of nitrogen, reducing erosion, reducing runoff, increase the soil matter, increase pH buffering. All these wonderful effects enhance the soil structure through cover crops, and the more varieties, the better. Diverse root exudates. Okay, this is like, here's the deal. Normal plants, when they have a decent amount of organic matter around them and they've got some security, they'll have some food. What they do is they take as much as half of their sunshine and push it out as sugary, mucousy exudates out their roots. They give this away, half of all their production. Why? Because it feeds a gigantic bloom of life around their roots. It's kind of like going from a bare-rooted plant to a wet, slimy, bacterial sock, completely enclosing the plant and protecting it from other invaders and nematodes and pests. But what happens is that sugar creates a feeding frenzy with bacteria. Bacteria populations explode. Predators for bacteria get the message. They come, so the paramecians and the amoebas and the other critters are eating there, chomping on those bacteria. What happens? It's carnage. What happens after the carnage? A lot of waste products. Aqueous ammonia at the root tip, on-time delivery. Not nitrogen pellets sprinkled in the top. And what is it? The more plants there are, the more exudates there are, and the more different kinds of flavors of exudates there are, and the more kinds of bacteria there are, and the more kinds of predators there are, and the bigger that diversity, the better the nutrition for the plants. Gives me goosebumps. The taproot's excess minerals, 100% solar absorption, and root masses pulse with grazing. When that big buffalo herd went through the prairie, they ate everything and stomped the rest, and the grass had to die back because the green grass now can't support all this root that they had. So the roots got to die back. What does that do? Well, the roots turn into humus deep in the soil, and the holes that used to be roots are now pathways for the earthworms and the water and the air to move through the soil. So, on-demand nitrogen. Why your soil test may be meaningless. What are you testing? Well, most people are testing the nitrogen they poured onto the top of the soil. Where does nature create the nitrogen? At the root tip, from the carnage, as much as they need. Liquid root exudates, a bacterial bloom, the predator carnage, root scavenging, organic nitrogen, and plant growth hormones. Not only do they trade, they have bacteria that trade sugar for plant growth hormones that make the plants grow faster. It's diverse and amazing. Creates a living membrane of beneficials around the roots. Here's a mob of cows. They find that they move them every day. The ground is fertilized with concentrated manure and urine. The deep roots die back and rot, fixing carbon in the soil and creating an easy path for new roots. The soil is dimpled by hooves, creating small pools, increasing rain infiltration. It's an ideal opportunity for reseeding. You can just drive over and throw the seed out. stomped, ready to go. Cows have flies. Flies lay their eggs and they get in the cow poop. The fly eggs are going to hatch in 3 days. You know what they do? They turn out the chickens in 3 days. What do the chickens do? Well, those little flies have tasty, sweet larvae in the manure. And what would a chicken do with a cow pie full of tasty, sweet larvae? It would scratch it all up and eat it and peck it. And it would trade the smelly, wet, evaporative cow pie for a dry, crystalline, urea-laced piece of manure that's not going to evaporate. That's even more concentrated nitrogen source. So here's a multi-species mob grazing, sheep, red deer, and cattle in New Zealand. And this is the picture I want to talk about. What's happening is this liquid carbon pathway. Carbon absorbed, turned from by sunshine into photosynthesis, turned to liquid sugar in the plant, and exuded through the plant tip, and that liquid carbon pathway deep into the soil. What you see here is a pumice soil, you know, pumice, lava soap. It's a pumice soil. See these trails? This is the stain of the organic matter permeating the humus, causing more and more trails of life deep into the soil that can't be evaporated. With 4 to 5% organic matter, all these wonderful things happen. What happens is, the best thing that I want to talk about is complete protein synthesis. If we have this gigantic community, every plant has every building block they need to grow. If we spread artificial fertilizers, plants have to skip parts in their code. An organic vegetable will store in your refrigerator or on your counter for days longer than an inorganic one. They have complete protein synthesis. And if you eat a plant that's been synthesized organically, you're going to be healthy too. This is a root wad from a guy that I've met and talked with, Gail Fuller from Emporia. Even when it's 5 degrees outside, it's like 40 degrees an inch down. There's so much bacterial activity below the soil that his soil doesn't freeze. The soil has a good crumb structure. The stickiness of that humus and that carbon glues the soil together. And then there are fungi, mycorrhizal fungi, which means root fungus. When the fungi were here a long time before they were green plants. And these fungi now associate with green plants and go out and increase the root area of the soil, of the plant, by 30,000%. There's fossilized evidence of fungi cracking rocks. That's what they do. They crack rocks. They dissolve minerals and bring them back. So if your mineral test says you need boron, you probably don't need boron. Why? Because you just need fungi. And if you plow, you kill them all. There's also a chelation effect. When we have brown fields, the best thing we can do, brown fields are the hazardous waste industrial sites, best thing we can do is put compost on them, get life going on them. Biochar is a huge piece of this. We have much to discover in this middle realm, just below us and within us. The mysteries around us are real and deserve our attention and focus. It's a lot too much to talk about in 35 minutes, but I hope you're not too dizzy. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Stan. That was great. We will now take questions, and our rules are that we want questions and not long comments, and one question per person until everybody's had a chance. So I'll hand it back over to Stan.
Oh, yes, sir.
Could you talk a little bit about the relationship between what you've discussed and the fact that we know that we need to farm with less and less water? Could you talk about the relationship between those two elements?
Right. Healthy plants use less water, need less water. They come from a place where the water is held in the soil as a sponge. A gram of carbon holds 8 grams of water. in the soil. Healthy plants also, because they've got all they need to make their livelihood, create their own cuticles and lose less water. So they're able to transpire better. There's this year, this month's article talks about soil and water. It talks about how they're intimately interconnected. Sun shines on the soil right now where 3% of the sun's energy is being absorbed. But if it were 1% or less, we would change the temperature of the soil and the temperature of the earth, increase our humidity, increase our cloud cover, and there's a lot that can happen through this method just as a piece of it, because it's not some method that people designed. It's the way the world works, and that's a very powerful thing to say. But irrigation is welfare, and it doesn't really work. We need to be doing things in those dry climates like mob grazing, and it sounds crazy, but it really works.
Thank you so much for your presentation. My question would be to you, what are some of the things that, you know, we can extrapolate farming organically to? And I know you touched on using the word organically, but maybe stress the importance of buying organic food. You know, you mentioned Monsanto briefly, but they're such a huge part of the conversation, especially in this part of the country and how they control whatnot. So what could you tell people about the importance of buying organic or some of the other large ramifications like ocean acidification and the killing of the pollinators and things like that we could do with voting with our dollars?
Kansas City is considered a hotspot in the United States for this organic movement and for the small farm movement, thanks to the Green Party meeting here in 1984 and 5, and Abby and a bunch of other people we had, Addie, that worked on this. We have a giant movement here, and that's happening. And the fact that people are so concerned about their health, because if they're paying attention, you would be being concerned about your health. I think it's a movement that's not stoppable. I think it's a piece of the revolution that's in place and in progress. I'm very optimistic about it, because Monsanto only wants to buy Ron Helland's formula and steal it, you know, and use it and hold it. They don't really have any juice. All we're doing here is facilitating nature, and that's really juicy. I may not have answered all your questions, but yes, this does a great deal of that, and I'll be glad. By the way, I'll just give you one term. Just look up Acres USA. It's a magazine that's 50 years old. I knew the publisher while he was still alive. My grandfather gave me copies. So if you want to read about the forefront of this movement, just get Acres USA.
Hi, and I also want to thank you for an excellent presentation. I wonder to what extent home gardeners can incorporate any of these principles and where we would find out about that. Let's say I have a 100-square-foot garden and want to use some of these principles.
I overseeded my lawn with clover, because it was low enough that I can mow over it and still get an occasional white flower for the bees. But just, you know, your lawn's a lot bigger than your garden. Think about how we could, and start reading and studying about how we can put diversity in our lawns. And a lawn is a monoculture that's only this deep and needs water and, you know, all those bad things. But I'm trying to do that. From the garden side of it, I'm trying to work on more on cover crops, planting cover crop mixes, and there's a whole greencovercrops.org is a place in Nebraska that has a whole calculator. When's your crop go in? When can I fix it? You know, what are my goals? And you push all the buttons, you come out with a computer thing, and they mail you a mix of seeds that's your baby. And starting in like August, when things are starting to wind down in your garden, or at least the main crops are in place and you could plant underneath them, planting cover crops is really good. Also, increasing the organic matter, that's huge. Compost covers, by the way, I just took a job, my first job in 30 years. Outreach and education coordinator for Missouri Organic Recycling. and they're the biggest compost manufacturer in the region. So, yay, I'm going to be working with 42 Shawnee Mission school districts to get the plastic contamination out of their food waste streams and bring more food waste composting in line and get that wet, slimy stuff out of the landfill and then move that way. But also, I have a service called Sudden Gardens. You can look it up on Facebook, Sudden Gardens. But I'll either till in what I believe is the best mix for your current soil and create a garden that way. And you'll go from 2 or 3% organic matter to 15% organic matter. And I also build box gardens where I haul in everything for your garden. So organic matter is what we're getting from those natural systems. And, you know, you say, we shouldn't till. And say, this is clay, man. Let me put a giant wad of compost in place. This one time, we've got spores for those mycorrhizal fungi. We can spread them while we're doing it, you know. And that big change is very important. That's what I believe we can do. Yeah.
I wanted to know, I've got about a third of an acre that I grow food on. And
you're busy.
But joyously so, joyously, because I'm an organic grower. But I've often wondered, and I will confess, because unfortunately I can't have growing food be my only job. So I'm oftentimes having to split what I focus on my land with what I need to focus to make a living. And oftentimes I find I miss having the time available when I would be going out and planting cover crops, right? So what I have been doing...
Mulch.
Really?
Mulch.
Really? Okay. What I've been doing...
cover crops are mulch. Mulch does a lot of the same things, but go...
Well, no, that's all right. That's all right. See, I didn't know that just keeping mulch on the ground would even help, but actually what I've been doing is I've just been allowing the weeds to grow on the land, and I do find that come spring, when I'm prepping the land for planting, where I've just let the weeds have it, there's a ton of earthworm activity. So what I need to know is there a benefit of like these cover crop cocktails above just letting the weeds take over the land in the fallow season?
Some of the plants in the cocktails are weeds.
So is this you telling me just let the weeds have it, or is there a benefit to having these other types of cover crops?
A mix of perennials and annuals is a good thing, and there are more perennials in the weed in the cover crop mixes.
Okay.
Normally, but Gail Fuller, the guy with the root mass that was standing up there, his garden looks like hell.
Yeah. Oh, mine is. It's just looks like, you know, yeah.
It's weeds. It's, you know, vetch and legumes and all kinds of things like that. And he just basically does the Fukuoko, the Japanese guy, One Straw Revolution, throws seeds and finds them where they grow.
Okay.
And he gets some really good surprises.
Yeah.
You know, he pulls this weed, you know. And I'm doing it now. I pulled a bunch of weeds the other day. And I'm replacing them with mulch. But the earthworm activity is just amazing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, what are weeds' function? To restore the balance to the soil after disturbance. And we're disturbers.
Yes.
We're the great oxidizers of the world, you know, and we got to get back to carbon fixers.
Okay, thank you.
God bless you. Best of luck. Take it easy on yourself. Yes. You'll always miss something. It's okay.
Talking with Wes Jackson, he comes out of the agricultural colleges and is trying to promulgate the things he believes in by educating the college agricultural departments. How have you, or how do your the people you know, how are you trying to promulgate these ideas with the general agricultural community?
There's a conference in Salina called No Till on the Plains, and it's giant. because no-till is mainstream. And what's happening is no-till on the plains is being subverted by this agenda. Now think about a farmer who has to buy fertilizer, buy GMO seeds, buy fuel, and then sell his product to a multinational who's rapacious, ADM, all these people, you know, Cargill. So you give him a whiff of going from three crops whose price he can't control to 15 crops of grass-fed beef selling at premium dollar, grass-fed chicken selling at premium, vegetables that he can sell, all these things that he can do and get retail. And not just retail, but organic retail. Whole paycheck, you know. Whole Foods is often called whole paycheck because it's really expensive. Well, guess what? He gets a chance to do that. And it's, and then be a good steward at the same time? Oh, my. It's an intoxicating mix. And this revolution, as far as I can see, is spreading like wildfire. And I'm not worried about going to the colleges. They'll be the last. You know. But they'll come out and they say, ooh, what's happening here? You know, what it is ain't exactly clear.
I'd like to ask a question about how this movement impacts the future of work and the distribution of humans between urban settings and rural settings. There's a huge debate now in the tech world that basically we're going to automate humans into lounge chairs somewhere. I don't have a lot of confidence in that, but this is the first thing that I've seen that might have the potential to restore dignified work in rural areas. Am I imagining that it takes more people to do this, or what is the thinking about that?
It has that potential. It has that potential because... I don't think there's much magnetism in the current agricultural model for young people. But this model, I think, is an exciting model. And I think people will understand it, will want to grow their families around it, will want to take that family farm and use it in this way. And even boomers confessing on their deathbed that they've done something ugly with their lives are willing to see this change. So I see that there can be a much better density and local food everywhere. And there's an old model called the Buffalo Commons. See, everywhere west of Salina, we train cowboys instead of coyotes, and we move them, and we herd them, and we share, do a communal pasture setting. And... you know, we don't need feedlots. Get better tasting beef, healthier beef. We don't need, 80% of the crops are corn grown for feedlots? For herbivores that aren't supposed to eat grain? How sick is this?
Great.
So, thank you.
Thank you, Stan. Stan, no. We want to present to you your honorarium for today.
I know. My last one is starting to fade, so
I'm... Oh, good. Right. All right. Well, this is our also Unitarian Universalist Forum mug, U.S. made.
Yeah.
All for you, so we'll hope to have you back again. Yeah. Thank you so much. And Stan will be available in the library here right after the forum.
See my books and magazines.
And, please. Yeah, he'll have books and magazines, and you can make comments and speeches and ask additional questions. Now, this is, for this season, the last forum, a very good one. But you can also come back at 10 a.m. on subsequent Sundays for the Religious Odysseys series, which happens every summer, where you have discussions about what your particular theology is about, and there'll be presentations on that. So be sure and come back for that. And you're also welcome to attend the service at 11:15. So thanks so much for coming to the forum.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, The Soil Will Save Us with Stan Slaughter. Tonight is the final All Souls Forum of the season. Starting next Wednesday at 6 p.m., we will transition into our summer format called The Forum, which features a broad range of local and regional speakers who will educate, entertain, and enlighten you. So please tune in next week, same time, same place. This program was recorded on Sunday, May 28th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember to call and support the station and this program during the fund drive so we can continue to provide programming that is organic, locally sourced, and non-GMO, only at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.